Simon Solomon, Chris Hedges, and more. This film champions the idea of an independent media where truth and integrity are the norm, not the exception. Again, that's the Shadows of Liberty Screening and Media Reform Action Tour, Friday, December 12th, 7 p.m. at the Oregon Labor Center, 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Naomi Munavira was born in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and immigrated with her family to Nigeria when she was only a toddler. In 1984, after 8 years residing in Nigeria, a military coup necessitated yet another move, this time to Southern California. She has been a Californian since then, but with current ties to the Bay Area. Her experiences of migration and secondhand knowledge of the civil war in her native Sri Lanka inspired her first novel, Island of a Thousand Mirrors. This is the story of women from both Tamil and Sinhalese families as they navigate their lives amidst this war. During her visit to Portland for an author reading, she sat down with me at KBOO. We began our conversation with an understanding of the Sri Lankan War and how that impacted Naomi's life as an impressionable teenager.
I had grown up in this very small village in Nigeria, and then coming to LA, I was so lost. I just didn't know anything about the geography of the place I was in, and it was so just enormous and overwhelming. I feel like it was just like this complete sort of lost experience for quite a long time.
To be fair, I think that's how we all feel when we go to LA if you're not from there.
Right.
Well, talk about how your upbringing and experiences fed into your writing.
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So the book I wrote, Island of a Thousand Mirrors, is about the civil war in Sri Lanka, and it follows two families through that experience. I think what was happening is that because I grew up in America, I had this civil war that went on from 1983 till 2009. Such a long, long time for any country to go through a civil war. And I was in America, but every year of my growing up, we would go back to Sri Lanka for a month. So I had this interesting relationship with Sri Lanka where I had sort of a foot in for a month of a year, and then the rest of my time was in America. So it's this very like split experience of being in America, going to American high school and college and being very safe, and then going back to Sri Lanka and being in a place where there was active warfare going on, feeling what it was like for my cousins who lived there permanently, the sense of like anxiety and just not being safe. And all of that sort of translated into some point me being like, these are just issues that I had sort of held with me for a very long time. And I started writing the book in 2001, but I think that the seeds of it were with me for much, much longer. And I think really the war was the background of my life for so long, and it was an issue I was grappling with for all of that time.
For those of us who aren't as familiar with the Sri Lankan Civil War, maybe give a little bit of background on that.
Okay, so the Civil War was between the, it's an ethnic war, it's not a religious war. Most people think it has to do with religion, but it's actually ethnic. It's between the Sinhalese and the Tamils. The Sinhalese, which is my ethnic group, is 70% of the island, and then the Tamils are 13%. And there's a long history, but basically what happened in 1983, there were these really terrible race riots in Colombo, the capital, and Tamil people were targeted. About 3,000 Tamil people were killed. their businesses and homes were destroyed, and people were just burnt on the street, and all this just terrible, violent scenes were happening, like in Colombo, which is the capital. And as a response, a lot of Tamil people got militarized, and the Tamil Tigers, which is this either terrorist group or freedom fighters, as they were thought of at the time, came into power in the north of the country and then waged a war with the Sri Lankan government till 2009. So, you know, 80,000 to 100,000 deaths, and a country that just lived under this very brutal war for a long, long time.
And I'm processing that information.
It's a lot. It's a lot to process. Yeah.
Because, right, it really doesn't get a lot of attention in this country. I think in international news would get a little bit of attention, but not so much here. And war.
I mean, I feel like there are these conflicts around the world, and if America is not invested, they're not going to pay attention. So the way we would get our news would be BBC, or if there was a really big bombing. What the Tigers did was they sort of innovated suicide bombing. So they would drive trucks into like banks or blow up buses in all over the country and cause civilian deaths. So if one of those events happened, then there would be more. Maybe CNN would cover it or something, but it had to be something quite large. And growing up here, you know, you would get these like tidbits, and you'd be sort of driving to school, and then you would hear the BBC or CNN would be like, this happened in Sri Lanka. And it's such a strange experience to be in America and be in safety and then hear the report, or maybe hear like a reporter on the ground and like people are running around and speaking in a Sinhala, which I understand. But you're in America, so it's this distance and separation. So I might understand what the people on the ground are saying, but to the people around me, it's this completely invisible, hidden thing that's happening around somewhere across the world, you know, that is almost not happening because it's not here, not talked about.
And how this plays into your book, you're covering a span of a couple generations, mm-hmm. in a couple different families, who are both Sinhalese and Tamil. Mm-hmm. You've given equal support to these characters. Mm-hmm. And talk about going through that process.
Right. I mean, the project of the book was very much about not having a particular political stance, because as a writer, I'm completely not interested in politics. What I was really trying to do was like present these people as human beings going through tragedy and going through catastrophe and warfare, and just say these are people. You know, they have this one family happens to be Sinhalese and this one family is Tamil, and their circumstances are quite different because the Sinhalese family migrates to America and are dealing with migration, whereas the Tamil family is in the north of the country and dealing with active warfare. But at the end of the day, it's not politics. It's just about human beings reacting to tragedy. And that's what I was really interested in. So, I mean, if a different sort of book would be, if I had sort of a political bend, I would consider that more propaganda. But fiction, like the point of fiction is not propaganda, right? So the push of fiction is really to make us understand what other human beings are going through and to make us have feelings. So that was really what I was trying to get at. And I mean, the idea of talking about a war that really happened, I think the point is to make it tangible and make it emotional for the reader. Whereas like you can read a history book and you get all the facts and figures and you get all the political nuance, but at the end of the day, it's not going to sort of affect you or make you understand what these people went through. And fiction can do that like so much more effectively.
Absolutely. I was wondering if you enjoyed writing from any particular character's perspective and if there was an inspiration towards this.
Right. I mean, that's a great question. So here's the thing, like when you do read the book, it's quite, it's a hard book because a lot of hard things are happening. There's quite a lot of painful stuff. I mean, okay. there's also, you know, sex and love and all of that fun stuff. But some of this book was really painful to write because I did a lot of research, and then one of my characters actually, the girl growing up in the north of the country through a series of circumstances ends up becoming a suicide bomber. So her story was particularly difficult to write from an emotional standpoint. So I have a lot of readers say, God, you like really affected me. And I cried reading this scene. And I have to say, yeah, you know, you have to realize that if you are affected, then the writer is also affected quite probably more, because I'm sitting with that scene for months and writing it and re-editing it and all of that. So for the most part, this was a very difficult book to write. It took me a very long time. And on the flip side of that, like, writing is such a pleasure and it's the thing I enjoy most of all. And when it's going really well, there isn't, I mean, I'm sure people out there that are writers or love expressing themselves in whatever way, there just isn't anything more joyful. So everything's working, right? Like your brain is working and just everything is sort of working in a way that doesn't happen in your other life. And that's sort of the pleasure of it.
And so, speaking of these very difficult experiences, which are, for our readers, you know, and listeners, wrapped in other wonderful human experiences as well, I'm curious how did the Sri Lankan American community receive your book, and other readers, other reading communities,
right,
receive your book?
Right. So the book was first published in 2011 in Sri Lanka, and then in India, and then in America, just September 2014. And each of these audiences have had quite different reactions to the book, depending, of course, on like political circumstances and history and all of that. In Sri Lanka, I mean, it was quite profound for me that the book was first published in Sri Lanka. I had tried to publish here for maybe like 5 or 6 years and gotten just a no across the board. And then through some really beautiful circumstances, it was accepted in Sri Lanka. And that was kind of amazing, because it's like, I didn't grow up there. I didn't live through this war, but people that had the experience of growing up through this war were saying, yes, you got it right, or you got some of it right, or we resonate with it, or we accept it. And sort of as a person living in the West, it's like, oh my God, okay, that's some really incredible affirmation. So I went back in 2012 for the book launch in Sri Lanka, and for the most part, it was really well received and really good reviews and all of that. Then the other side of that is like the Sri Lankan government does not want to talk about this war at all. So I had some very vociferous reviews in the pro-government papers that said things like, why has she written this book about this war? That's a dead subject. It ended in 2009. We sort of buried that subject. You shouldn't write about it. You know, this sort of really hard push towards silence. And Sri Lanka is a place where journalists and activists disappear all the time. So there is this way in which people are told not to talk about it. And part of that is like, it's ancient history. We're over it. Our economy is booming. Everything's great. But I mean, that's ridiculous, right? Like, the project of literature is to examine these things and excavate them and talk about them for, you know, centuries if we need to, because that's how you process and heal trauma. And some of these reviews were like really personal. I got called quite a few names. And so I was there for 2 months living by myself. And, you know, I was, you know, any knocks on the door were quite anxiety provoking and that kind of thing.
Did you actually get any threats? Having these horrible insults hurled at you is terrible as well. But
right.
Being there alone.
Yeah, I mean, it was scary for sure. I had at my book launch, I had a person who is the editor of the biggest pro-government paper show up and basically say, why have you written this? You're American. You have no right. And I said, you know, OK, I accept that. But have you read the book? And he said, no. And I said, OK, well, then you need to have read the book and then we can talk, because I'm really not advocating any sort of political lean. And he was really angry. So he wrote this sort of fiery attack of the book. And for those 2 weeks, I was really scared. Nothing happened, but I was sort of expecting at any moment people could come to my door, which happens. But the like the other side of that is I have an American passport, so I'm really immune from a lot of these things. If I was Sri Lankan living in Sri Lanka, and especially if I was Tamil, I would not be writing. I would not probably have written this book because it just would. It probably would not be safe.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Sarika Mehta with author Naomi Munavera in studio. Her debut novel, Island of a Thousand Mirrors, has won many South Asian literary prizes. We were just discussing some of the tensions she experienced upon the publication of her book in Sri Lanka after spending a decade producing this novel.
Wow. I mean, there's a lot to unpack. I was thinking about what we were talking about before the interview mm-hmm. started about mm-hmm. the lack of role models that artists in the South Asian American community of our generation can look up to. And then when you're trying to make this into a viable career, your life in some ways, your book is also on the line because I guess talk about some of the situation with role models and expectations.
Interesting. Okay, role models, first of all. Okay, so I got to America in 84 when I was 12. And just Sri Lanka was just absent, you know, or even South Asia was sort of not present in my life at all. When I sort of landed in Arcadia, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and the only way people could understand what I was, they thought of as Mexican because I was brown and they didn't really have any context to fit me in. So this is like profoundly confusing time. And Salman Rushdie says this thing about migration, which is that it throws everything into conflict. And I think that's really true. Like everything is confusing. And so like zero role models, you know, especially in literature, I was a huge reader all my life and really thirsty and looking for myself in the page and not finding that and not even knowing that it was an absence. So when I was growing up in Nigeria, we were all reading like Enid Blyton. I don't think Americans know this stuff, but it's like British and it's super colonialized stuff about British kids in British boarding schools. And like all I wanted to do was like go to a British boarding school and like eat kippers and these things that I didn't even know what that was, but I wanted that because it was so desirable and it was on the page, which means that as a young person, like your desires can be formed by what you see like on the screen or on the page, and totally not seeing myself, not thinking my experience was valid. At some point I discovered like Michael Ondaatje, which was amazing, Shyam Salvadore, who they're both Sri Lankan writers in the West. And then, of course, like Gabriel Garcia Marquez and all these writers of color. And that was like, oh, my God. And then the Indian writers. And then, oh, there's like a few Sri Lankan writers. So, okay, like finding yourself in the pages, especially Shyam Salvadore, who wrote a book called Funny Boy, which was about a gay Sri Lankan guy. Like, I think that came out in the 80s. That was like mind-blowing. Like, oh, my God, it's about Sri Lanka. Like, you can actually talk about families like mine. That's amazing. And actually, like, he and I are now friends, and we taught a sort of writing course in Sri Lanka 2 years ago. So that's been just absolutely mind-blowing. But he was one of my first sort of outlets to the idea that you could write about your own community and that that was important and people would want to know about it. And then the other question about growing up, I mean, like as South Asians, it's doctor, lawyer, engineer, those are your choices. So my sort of way around that is, you know, growing up, all I wanted to do was read books. And I'm like, how do I figure that out? Okay, I'll get a degree in English. And my parents are like, okay, we'll let her do that because then maybe she'll be a lawyer. Then I get to like the end of my undergraduate, I'm like, oh, I don't want to be a lawyer. Okay, I'll be a PhD. I can keep reading books, then I can do that for the rest of my life. Okay, so PhD track, you know, doing the whole thing. And I really quickly got to the dissertation part. And as soon as I hit the dissertation, like the only thing that was coming to me was fiction. I was trying really hard to write this like academic paper and nothing, like it wasn't happening. Just these characters were coming and they were talking. I'm like, oh my God, it's a novel. It's a novel about the war. And my advisor was like, well, this cannot be your dissertation. So I dropped out. which is what you should do. No, not really, but and I make it sound easy, but it was not easy because having a South Asian family, they were like, what are you doing? My dad, for a very long time, said it was the worst thing that had happened in his life. And it's also such a fraught thing because, like, I started writing in 2001. The book was published in 2011. And all of that time, you just don't know if anything's going to happen with it. And sort of as a writer, you have to assume probably not, because it's incredibly difficult to publish a book. I mean, now my parents are really into it, and the book's been up for prizes and stuff, so of course that makes it much easier. And so my dad no longer says, you know, this is the worst thing. He's like, oh, you were right. Like, okay, good. But as a South Asian kid, I mean, it's so hard to buck those voices that are telling you that this is the way you should live your life. This is like safety. And I think it's changing now. I mean, we've got like Mindy Kaling and stuff. You know, there's so many more role models, and there's so many ways we get to see ourselves out there.
It's just, well, to come full circle, to fight this hard for this career, which is hard for anybody, to have to prove yourself, to fight this hard, the work, especially 10 years on a book, that's quite a commitment, you know. Yeah. So congratulations to you, because it's not easy. And then when it did come out, you... Yeah. Had kind of a scary outlook for it too in Sri Lanka. I mean, that's a lot to commit to. That's just
right. I mean, yeah, it's interesting, right? Like, I sort of almost didn't think about it. I just did this thing that was really pressing to be born, and on my good writing days, I feel like a conduit, and I feel like, okay, this is sort of coming from somewhere else. And that's not every day, you know. Some days it's really a struggle. But there were moments where I was really discouraged. I mean, imagine you start writing in 2001. This particular book I finished in 2007 or 8, and then tried to sell for the longest time, and everybody said no.
Did they tell you why they said no? Are you allowed to share that?
Sure, yeah. But basically what happened is, so we, in 76, we moved to Nigeria. And in Nigeria, we had a community of expatriates that we were part of. And my best friend there was a Sri Lankan girl. Really close, you know, like at that age, you're like best friends forever kind of thing. In 84, there were political problems in Nigeria. And we all sort of left very quickly because we thought that at some point they might do what they did in Uganda, which is tell the Asians to, like, leave overnight. So there were these rumblings, and it didn't quite come to that place, but we were afraid that it would, so we decided to leave really quickly. Her family went to Canada and then back to Sri Lanka. My family came to America. So I go through junior high school, college, PhD, drop out of PhD, write the book in 2001 start. I finished in about 2007, got an agent, and he read it and he said, this book isn't finished. And I was like, you. It is finished, and I don't want to write it anymore. And he's like, well, but I don't know what happens to these characters. And the problem was, the war wasn't over yet, so I didn't know how to end it. Like, I ended at an earlier place in the book. And then in 2009, the war ended. I'm like, oh, I know how to end my book. So I wrote the finishing part in 2009. He then chopped it to all the American houses, and they all said no. And they don't have to give you a lot of reasons, but I think it was just an unknown author, a war in a very far place that nobody really knew anything about, untested. I've heard that the writing is really, quote unquote, overwrought, which I think translates to lush and descriptive, but sort of this, it's, America is really interested in sparse language, and this is very sort of lush language, and they didn't like that, a whole bunch of reasons, but also because it's untested, and the publishing industry is like in such sort of, they're figuring out what to do, so it was a like huge bet they would have to take on it, and they didn't. Okay, so then I'm like, okay, I'm going to write my second book. So I started writing a different book. In the meantime, in about 2011, my best friend from Nigeria, the little girl, contacted me on Facebook we started reconnecting, and she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, I wrote this book. I'm trying really hard to find a publisher. And she says, oh, my best friends in Sri Lanka run a publishing house. Here's our information. So they were the first to take it on, and they're tiny. They're like a husband and wife team. They run it out of their garage. They printed maybe 1,000 books, and they just got really behind it. And they put it up for all the Asian prizes. So the Man Asia, the Commonwealth, the DSC. And then suddenly what started happening is it started getting long and shortlisted. So it was longlisted for the Man Asia, shortlisted for the DSC prize, and it won the Commonwealth for Asia. And then it got bought in India. So that was a big deal. And it was put out by Hachette. And then America was like, oh, hello, okay. And then there was a small bidding war, and they St. Martin's, which is part of Macmillan, bought two books. So I'm actually working on the second, and they put this out in September, early September this year. So that's the whole publishing story.
And you were in our backyard the whole time,
right? But I think like America wanted to know that it would sell and that there was like this history and it had done well. So it was much easier for them to be like, okay, we'll take a chance on you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that is quite a story. Naomi Murueira, thank you so much for joining me here at KBOO Community Radio.
Yay. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
That was writer Naomi Murueira, author of Island of a Thousand Mirrors. You can get her debut novel wherever books are sold. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
Yes, and your Thursday morning on KBOO Community Radio continues with Words and Pictures. It's a show that features conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. Thank you, KBOO members. Your generous support in our recent mini membership drive helped us exceed our fundraising goal. Words and Pictures, coming up next on KBOO.
KBOO at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Bernat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Christmas Revels 2014, December 18th through the 23rd at St. Mary's Academy in downtown Portland. Christmas Revels is a popular form of seasonal production that features traditional dances, music, and songs in celebration of the winter solstice. Again, that's the Christmas Revels, Thursday through Tuesday, December 18th to the 23rd at St. Mary's Academy, 1615 Southwest 5th Avenue, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're paying tribute to Jack Oman, whose political cartoons graced the editorial page of The Oregonian for nearly 30 years. And before leaving Portland for Sacramento, Jack made an appearance and answered questions at a special reception in his honor. So today we're going to play that farewell address from December 2012 at the Oregon Historical Society, and Jack will be introduced by Oregon Historical Society Chair, Kerry Timchuk.
Well, good evening. I'm Kerry Timchuk, Executive Director of the Oregon Historical Society. And David McCullough once wrote that history is who we are and why we are the way we are. And for the last 30 years, one Oregonian has helped hundreds of thousands of Oregonians with a great look at history and kind of deciding who we are and why we are the way we are. For almost 30 years, Oregonians have opened up their newspaper and looked to see the work of Jack Oman. He has enlightened us, he has entertained us, he has educated us, he has inspired us, he has infuriated us. He's done all that, and now after this